Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is February 8th, 2022, and my guest is author and columnist Tamar Haspel of The Washington Post. Her latest book and the topic of today's conversation is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. Tamar, welcome back to Econ Talk.
It's great to be back, Russ.
This is Tamar's second appearance. She was here in July of 2017. This is
that long ago.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's COVID and everything. There are a lot of things to make life and timing difficult. I found this to be a very charming and surprisingly moving book. It is a story of what you call firsthand food. What is firsthand food?
Firsthand food is anything you get dirty in the service of. So it's anything you get with your own two hands. And for a lot of people, that's gardening, fishing and hunting, also foraging, raising livestock. And my husband and I spent, you know, a decade plus doing all of those things. And like you, I found it surprisingly moving.
And we're going to talk about that, but just some of the your list includes things you did all those things or have done.
Yeah, I did all those things and I still do many of those things.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about some of the details of that, but also how it changed you and how it made you think about food and where you belong in the cosmos. There's a lot of very superficial and entertaining parts of the book and some very deep and thoughtful parts of the book. But let's start with just the basics. You started with a goal of eating something firsthand every single day, right?
We did. And this was on the heels of a sort of a lifestyle U-turn. My husband and I lived in New York City. We lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And we ended up on Cape Cod almost by accident. The internet was disrupting both of our professions. And we decided it was time for a change. And so we traded in our Upper West Side apartment for a small house on 2 wooded acres on Cape Cod. And when we got here, we started looking around and saying, okay, well, what can we do here that we couldn't do in New York? And the answer was all kinds of stuff. And because I've been a food writer for a long time, I naturally started looking at food-related projects. And all of a sudden, instead of writing about things that other people were doing with food, I could do things with food myself. And so the first thing we did was plant a garden, but that just introduced me to the range of possibilities. And I thought, okay, well, there's lots of fishing here. There's decent foraging. What if we tried to do this firsthand food project? What if we try and eat one thing every day that we get firsthand? And Kevin, who is extremely supportive of my any venture that I undertake, and is also very can do. When I remember when I floated this to him, I said, "Honey, do you think we could do one food every day?" And he goes, "Not a chance." And I'm like, "Who are you? And what have you done with Kevin?" And I brought him around. But that first winter, I have to say, was that we ate a lot of clams that winter because we started doing this project in January where there just aren't that many options. So yeah, we still refer to it as our winter of shellfish.
But you know, it was a very shellfish winter, I thought. But and I have to say that most people who move from New York to Cape Cod would be thinking about the things they can't do on Cape Cod that they used to do in New York, but you went the other way. Very, very good idea. Was this kind of a shtick to start with? This one every day, eat something. Did you think to yourself, "Well, it's going to make a great book," and of course it has. And did you think it was going to be a year? And now it's been, you say, 12 years since you started it. T-
tell me about the what was your thinking?
Yeah, there was definitely a shtick element to it. And, you know, this was, I was looking for a hook to write about these things. And so the one a day part was definitely shtick. And I wanted to do it for a year, and I wanted to have a blog about it. At that point, I had no idea, you know, sort of the importance it was going to take on in my psyche, and that it would become a book. But I wanted a framework to write about these things, and so that's what we picked. And yeah, so it was more than a lark, but not much more.
Now, the book's short; it's 230 pages, and it's pretty big print. It could have been 600 if you described all the problems you had in detail. It was nice of you not to go into too much detail there. Kind of hit the high points, which I appreciate. But at one point, you said something about getting something like 30% of your calories firsthand. How much of that calculation did you do? And was 30% like the average? Like what would be a high number in a certain month? Do you have any feel for that?
I do, because I've done the math on all of these projects. And yeah, so we started off doing one food a day. But sometimes it felt like, all right, yeah, we ate a tomato from the garden, but that's really no big deal. It's not going to make an impact on our daily caloric requirements. And so as time went on, I started to want it to be a substantial part of what we ate. And it was also sort of an exercise in seeing just how feasible it was to get a decent proportion of our calories ourselves. And, you know, we have a lot of luxuries that most people don't have. I mean, we have flexible jobs, you know, we have enough financial security, so, you know, we can make small investments in these kinds of things. You know, we don't have kids at home. It's a lot easier for us to do these things than it is for a lot of people. And so I figure, okay, well, this is as close to as I'm ever going to get to understanding, you know, subsistence agriculture. And because I write about agriculture for a living, that was an interesting part of the exercise for me. And so, yeah, I did at one point start tracking our calories. And, you know, not to the nth degree. This was a back of the envelope calculation. Okay, we shot a deer. It was X pounds of venison. And at the end of the year, I would add up everything that we got. And the year that we did best, we got around 30% of our calories from food that we had gotten firsthand. And that surprised me because I thought we would do better. But it turns out so many of our calories comes from things I would never in my wildest dreams try and grow, like wheat. And we don't have the climate for things like fruit and nut trees, which is where you can really make a big difference in your caloric intake. And you know, collard greens just don't get you very far.
Now, you'd on the program the last time you conceded, and you mentioned again in this book that a fresh egg from a chicken in your backyard is, in a blindfold test, is indistinguishable from a store-bought egg, which is enraging to many chicken owners, but appears to be the case. And you could argue that all that really matters is the non-blindfold taste. The fact that blindfold, you can't tell them apart, is not relevant. If you think mm-hmm. it tastes better, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, of course, is that I think most people would assume that firsthand food tastes better generally. So why don't you quickly give a survey of some of the things that taste like radically better? Some of them taste worse. It's the wrong kind of fish. You mentioned a certain kind of tuna. To give us some of the one other footnote, the word shtick is Yiddish, I think. And it means kind of – it's a hard word to translate, but it's kind of like a gimmick for a comedic effect or a special effect, I would translate it as. Why did you want to do this? So talk about what was – one answer would be because everything tastes better, but that wasn't really the whole thing. So back up a little bit. Tell us why you wanted to do it, and then tell us what made a difference in the consumption that you thought was really magnificent, say, versus not so much change.
So I wanted to do it because it was interesting. And that's a profoundly unsatisfying answer. And when I first started doing it and writing about it on a blog, people would ask me why I was doing it. And there was an assumption a lot of the time that we were doing it because we were interested in self-sufficiency. But we are absolutely not interested in self-sufficiency. Kevin and I are staunch advocates of interdependence, and we think the world is better when we all get to trade things, and we're not interested in like building our own stockpile of food and, you know, protecting it against all comers. But to say, okay, well, I thought it was interesting, it doesn't really explain what's compelling about this. And it was only after I had done it for a number of years that I really understood what was so compelling about it, because I found my ideas about food shifting. And you know, one of the reasons, as you say, one of the reasons a lot of people talk about doing these things is because you get better food. And sometimes that's the case. So some of our big wins, certainly fish. Fish that you catch yourself is better than fish, and as long as you treat it properly, fish you catch yourself is better than fish that you get. Even like when I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, we bought our fish at Citarella, which is one of the top fish markets in the country, certainly in New York. And I figured this is as good as it gets, but it's not as good as it gets. As good as it gets is you catch it, you ice it, you take it home, and you eat it. And that's as good as it gets. But you do mention there is one fish that swims in these waters called a false albacore that is just not delicious no matter what you do to it. But the shiitake mushrooms that we grew, wild mushrooms that you forage, some of them are kind of slimy and unpleasant. But hen of the wood is delicious. Chanterelles, black trumpets, are delicious. The pigs and the turkeys that we raised were delicious, although it's hard for me to swear to that because they were so imbued with significance because we had raised them. So it could be, I could think that those were delicious for the same reason that other people think that, you know, an egg from the chicken coop tastes better, because eating things is more than about just, you know, the flavor of something, as you point out. And I will just add that nothing makes people madder with them. Anything that I've written, the thing that infuriates people is when I say that all eggs taste the same. But there are definitely some things that are not so good. And if you've ever gardened, I'm sure you have come across these things. We raised some of the woodiest green beans and sour blackberries, and some mushrooms, as I say, are really not delicious. But here's the thing about that isn't that's not super delicious about firsthand food is that it has an inherent problem. You have none at all until the very moment that you have much too much. And that's sort of the nature of seasonality. And you have no tomatoes, you have no tomatoes, you have no tomatoes, and all of a sudden you've got a bazillion tomatoes. And you don't think you're going to get tired of them until like the third week. And then you're like, oh, tomatoes again. And so what you do when you have too many tomatoes, or believe it or not, too many lobsters, and that happens, is you find a way to preserve them. And some people do a lot of canning or drying. I rely on freezers because I think that's the best way to handle most of this stuff. But then that puts you in the position of having to use the thing that comes out of the freezer. And at that point, you've lost any advantage of freshness. And the thing that you're working with is probably not as good as the thing that you would buy in the grocery store, at least some of the time. And I will vouch for that. And especially, what if it stays in the freezer a little too long? What if the vacuum seal is compromised and the fish has a little bit of freezer burn? So part of firsthand food is learning how to use those suboptimal things. And I got as much satisfaction out of making fish tacos with the compromised striped bass that was in my freezer for 7 months as I did from the fresh striped bass coming out of the ocean. And so it's the first-handedness that calls to me.
You mentioned that you weren't about self-sufficiency. You have a very nice boat that you did not construct from scratch in the book. You have a very good Ford truck that's large and can pull the boat. There's a bunch of other things you build, though, although not the hammer itself. So, but it's very clear that you're not a Luddite. You're not. This is not a anti civilization shtick. It's a different kind of shtick. And you
could
also
stop using that word, Russ.
Sorry. Don't take it personally. Don't take it personally. But you also point out that this is not generally, it is not a financially lucrative strategy in life. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and I've thought a lot about that, and I've crunched a lot of numbers. And there's a really funny passage in E.B. White's collection of essays called One Man's Meat. And he wrote these when he moved up to Maine from New York and he started raising animals. And this is with World War II looming in the late 30s. And at one point, he decides to raise turkeys. Okay, this is a decision near and dear to me because we did the same. And he writes about getting the poults and losing all birds but one to disease or predators. And by the time he adds up all of the money that he spent constructing the housing, calling the vet, getting the feed, he ends up with, you know, a $420 turkey. And this is in 1938 dollars. It's nuts. And then there's a funny part where he says, and this is not factoring my time. Now, a writer's time is notoriously difficult to account for because sometimes it is not worth the paper he is not writing anything on. So you can see why this essay spoke to me. And some of the things that we do pay for themselves. And I've run the math on the chickens. And if you amortize a coop that's not ridiculously expensive over, 10 years of a flock's life, you will be ahead on eggs. Certainly foraging is a huge win because there's really no investment to start. There are certain kinds of gardening, that do pay off. And of course, the better a gardener you are, the better it pays off. We're kind of crap gardeners and we have crap soil, so gardening isn't a big win. But again, those fruit and nut trees, ooh, that's a big win. In fact, the only one that is really not going to be a win is the one you mentioned, which is fishing. And that's weird because the fish that you catch is some of the most valuable firsthand food that you can get. I mean, striped bass can sell for over $35 a pound around here when it's in season. But you're never going to pay for the boat. But one of the good things about firsthand food is that most of it doesn't require much in the way of investment. Some of it's downright free. A lot of it is quite cheap. And it's really only fishing when you start getting equipment and boats and trucks that you get into expense.
A lot of this book is about the acquisition of skill. And one of my favorite episodes of Econ Talk is a monologue I did on David Ricardo and Adam Smith and the differences of their ideas about trade. And I start off with this example from Robert Frank about how he lived in Nepal with a highly skilled person who could repair his roof, kill a chicken, do 1,000 different things, but he had a very low standard of living. And of course, it takes extensive – my argument in that monologue is that it takes extensive interaction with others, trade, and the economies of scale that Adam Smith emphasized, not so much the comparative advantage side that David Ricardo emphasized, to make life yield a bounty, to have a high standard of living. And I thought it was fascinating. You didn't write about this, but I'll ask you to reflect on it now. You were an incredibly more skilled person than you were when 10, 12 years ago when you started this process. Just list some of the things that you know how to do. And I'm just going to add that they're wondrous and it's beautiful to read about your growth, but they didn't exactly make you rich because these skills require a much larger scope to and ability to trade with others and to add capital. But talk about some of the things you learned how to do in the course of this experience.
It's funny because you're zeroing in on exactly one of the things that was most important to me about doing this. And it was so compelling to me because, all right, I write for a living and I have spent many, many hours, articles trying to be a better writer. And I hope on a good day, I'm okay. But if you ask me for a skill that I am proud of, I will tell you that I can shoot, field dress, and break down a deer. And I'm proud of that because it was way outside my comfort zone. It was something I hadn't had any inkling of doing. And it's a little embarrassing to admit because, 200 years ago, any 8-year-old could do that. But skill acquisition is funny that way. Because it's not so much the magnitude of the skill, it's the steepness of the slope. So mm-hmm. you go from knowing nothing about something, and one of our first brushes with this was building the chicken coop. We didn't know jack about chickens. And we went to the internet like everybody else and looked at other people's coops, and Kevin mostly did the designing, and we decided how we were going to do it. And then we got the materials and we built the thing. And I learned to use power tools. And I learned a little bit about framing and construction. And I made a tragic mistake on the roof shingles. But Kevin doesn't hold that against me. But I think that there is something about skill acquisition. And I have a long list of them. It sounds stupid to say because it's such a small thing. I can fillet a mean fish. I know a little something about gardening. I can identify mushrooms and I can back down a trailer. And if you've never tried to do that, you're like, yeah, big deal. But it was a big deal because it's actually not that easy. It's not that hard. It just takes practice. It's not splicing a gene. But there's something about acquiring a brand new skill that builds you up. It buoys you. It makes you feel strong. And strength begets strength. And that was one of the best things about this experience. And it surprised me because, as you say, after I've told you, stop saying shtick, I went in with sort of this idea that it was a little bit of a shtick. And it became this thing that gripped me. And so, do you remember? I'm sure you do. The Marie Kondo bestseller, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. It was an international bestseller. And I picked it up because I'm like, what's all the fuss about tidying up? And Marie Kondo was on record saying, her clients went on after they used her method to clean up their house. They went on to ask for the promotion or change their diet, lose weight. Get the divorce that was overdue, whatever it was. I'm like, yeah, why? Because your house is clean? But that's not why. It's because people take a problem that is in their purview to solve, and they solve it. And that makes you big and bad and strong. And that was one of the things that surprised me most about this whole enterprise.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's moving about it. And I have to say, most of the skills that you use in the book, I don't have. The ones that I have a little bit of, they scare me a lot if you'd ask me to do them. So if you said fillet a fish, I've filleted, probably 3 or 4 fish in my life. And if you said, oh, we got company coming over, why don't you fillet these 4 fish? My heart would shrink. My stomach would hurt. And I think it's going to be a little pile of mashed up little pieces, not the kind you see at the store or that you've seen with a person on a boat who's skilled at it. And the idea of backing a trailer with a boat on it down a steep hill, that's one of the most frightening things I can possibly imagine. I would be humiliated to be, if you told me I would pay any sum of money not to do that and not to do it in front of a group of people who've done it often and are watching and going, let's say this guy put the boat over the edge, ruined his car, go down the hill, float his truck. So the idea of mastery, I think, is underrated in the human experience. And like you say, you and I have tried to master this, a skill called writing that I have worked at like you have, and with unmeasurable success. But these skills actually have a very tangible outcome. The boat is in the water and the truck isn't, or the fillets look like they should or they don't. And all of those things, I think, and the fact that they have been part of the human experience other than the boat for hundreds or thousands of years is also part of the mystique and the power of the things that you did.
As I said, it took me by surprise. And part of it was that these were all skills that were alien to me. But part of it was they were of a different order than the skills I had been accustomed to acquiring, which had to do with mostly, you know, what goes on inside your head. It's the life of the mind. It's how do I write better? How do I think better? How do I get a better handle on the issues that I write and think about? And, you know, you can do all of that in your armchair. And I was a big armchair aficionado, I have to say. And putting your phone down, rolling up your sleeves, going outside and doing a physical thing, something with your hands. And don't get me wrong, these all require thinking as well. But you have to execute, you have to use your body. And I had never done much of that. And I probably never would have if it hadn't been for marrying Kevin. And Kevin is a doer. He always has been. And he had physical skills. There were all kinds of things that he could do that I had no comprehension of. And under his, I would say, tutelage on some things, but certainly it was inspiring for me to see these skills in action. But there were some things that we learned to do together. He had never hunted deer either. And a lot of it was the pivot from just thinking to thinking and doing. And I feel like it rounded me out as a person. It helps me connect with other people who do these kinds of skills, who have these skills, but also who do this kind of work. We have a friend here, Gerald, who is one of the most skilled people I know. He does exquisite Finnish carpentry, and he's a terrific fisherman. And I watch as he's an immigrant from Brazil, and he watches people and he learns, and he's just constantly acquiring skills. And I'm like, I need to be more like Gerald. And it has been, I mean, when we came here, I was, 45? And so this is the time in your life where a lot of people are on the road that then they will continue on up until, you know, you're done. And to do something completely different in middle age that had me doing things that changed me as a person felt very, very satisfying. I keep saying this, I know, but it surprised me.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I would point out it's a luxury. You know, part of the lack of financial return to most of these things in small scale means that it's a bit of a luxury. It requires a certain source of income elsewhere to live the lifestyle that you have. But, you know, having said that, there are 1,000 things you can pick. It doesn't mean you have to have 30% of your calories come from first-hand food. You could just try to add something now and then. The book obviously reminded me somewhat of Michael Easter's book, The Comfort Crisis, where he talks about the Japanese concept of the misogi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but where you stretch yourself to do something that you try to do, you might not be able to do it. And if you achieve it, you take the pride in it that you're talking about. That would certainly, for me, include backing a boat down a steep ramp into a body of water. But I do think there is something profoundly human about adding the physical dimension. I am not a doer. I'm an undoer. I'm a super armchair guy. Nothing I like more than to read a book and get better at reading books. And it's been the main focus of my life is the inner life of the mind. And I'm not ashamed of it, but, but it's an interesting thing, especially as I get older, to think about the physical things that many, many people can do and that are mostly have been part of the human experience for not just decades, but millennia. And the book captures that.
Michael Easter and I were sort of friends, and we've talked about this and the similarities between his book and my book, because they're both about pushing boundaries. Now, he pushes them in ways that I can't go there with him. He ended up, you know, spending 30 days in the remote part of Alaska and shooting an elk and carrying 500 pounds of meat back. I mean, man, that's beyond my ken. But it's actually an interesting point, because it dovetails with what you said before about how a lot of the things we do, it's a luxury. And Kevin and I have time. We have enough money to do some of these things. We have flexible schedules. But one of the great things about firsthand food is that it's scalable. And so on the one hand, you have Michael Easter going to Alaska and shooting his elk. And then, you know, you come down from there and you have me going to Virginia and shooting my deer. And then, you know, there's some financial investments involved in fishing. But then you go down the scale. And if you don't have much time, if you don't have much money, there are always options. And that's one of the things that's great about it. And it doesn't have to be a lifestyle change to be interesting and moving and horizon expanding. It can be something small that you've never done before. You know, put some herbs in a window box. Get one of those crazy mushroom kits where, you know, you put it in the refrigerator and it grows. There's so many things that you can do that don't involve even, you know, having outdoor space. There's a woman who writes about food. Her name is Kat Kinsman. And she writes the Food and Wine, and she wrote this wonderful thing about growing a lemon tree indoors. And so you have this citrus fruit growing in your house, and it's the smell and using those lemons, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful piece. And so no matter where you are in your life, with your finances, with your time, you can fit something in and see if it speaks to you. I mean, I didn't go into this thinking it would be this, you know, big thing that would change me. It was just a fun thing to try. But you don't know until you actually do it. And that's kind of like the running theme here is doing.
Let's talk a little bit about death. One of the There are two times in the book where you really confront your food choice. You slaughter a turkey and you shoot a deer. And I assume many of your friends from Manhattan, first of all, many of them I assume are vegetarian or vegan. The ones who eat meat would find it somewhat repellent to actually cut the throat of the turkey or fire a rifle at a deer. And you also talk in the book very beautifully about how those practices you got good at, those skills, allowed you to interact with people who are very different from you politically, mm-hmm. philosophically. So I'm curious about that aspect of it. Talk about how you dealt with that emotionally, because it wasn't a light thing. It's clear. The book makes it very clear. But then, okay, so it's not a light thing. It didn't make you a vegetarian, though, or you're not a vegetarian. So how do you – I'm curious about the social aspect of it, both with your new friends who are hunters, say, your old friends who find hunting disgusting, and also just how you came to grips with it.
I think most of my old friends are omnivores, so there wasn't so much that. But they certainly weren't hunters.
Yeah.
And the idea that you go out in the world and kill your own food is certainly alien to a lot of people who I interacted with in New York, and I lived in San Francisco before I lived in New York, and this, you know, these are urban people, and it just wasn't part of our experience. And when I started doing First Hand Food, I didn't aspire to it because, I mean, I if I'm watching a movie and somebody kicks a dog, I look away. I can't, you know, on Wild Kingdom, I root for the gazelle. And it's, if you had told me when we started that I would learn how to use guns and I would kill animals, I'd be like, I'm not going there with you. but this is sort of another thing about skill acquisition is that, you know, you start in one place and who knows where you end up. And at some point, several years in, I decided, all right, well, I eat meat. I care about the lives my animals lead. And in for a penny, in for a pound. And so the first animal I killed was a turkey. And we worked hard to figure out the best way to do it. And I did it with great trepidation, but also with real commitment to doing it well. And that's the thing about killing an animal, is that you have to be able to set aside emotions about it when you're in the moment, because what matters is that you do it well, because there's something at stake. This animal's life is being taken, and you need to be able to take it with minimal pain and distress and suffering. And that needs, for me, that needs to be all I'm thinking about when that happens. And it was really hard for me. And it remains hard for me. And, you know, now when we slaughter birds, I've killed a fair number. But Kevin kills more of them than I do because he finds it less emotional. Whereas he hates pulling, you know, he hates cleaning them and pulling the guts out. And that doesn't bother me at all. So I do that part. And, but you're absolutely right that this is something that connects me to a group of people, hunters, who I had very little interaction with. But then because at the Washington Post, I write about agriculture, I talk to farmers, I visit farms, and sometimes standing in the middle of a cornfield, and we would both know there was a gulf between us, because most farmers in the country's heartland are Republicans. They're mostly older men. They're white. They live in communities where a lot of the life revolves around the church. I write for one of these coastal elite newspapers, and I'm so coastal, my socks are damp. And let's face it, you know, everything about me screams New York Jew. And here's this guy whose experience is so different from mine. He's wondering about what I'm going to say in print about him and his farm. I know that we come from two extremely different ideologies. We just don't have a lot of common ground. But lots of farmers hunt, or they have people come and hunt on their land because deer are a perennial problem in the heartland. And so we can often talk about hunting. And I'll show him the picture on my phone of the last deer I shot last season, and he'll show me his. And if you can talk about hunting, you can talk about guns. And if you can talk about guns, you can talk about anything. And it just, it establishes a common ground. And but this is the thing. It's not just about hunting. This is the thing about food, is that we all have this in common. And I'm so generally distressed about the state of public discourse, about poisonous polarization, about terrible nastiness and meanness and what goes on in the public sphere. And I really want to try and lead with the things that we have in common. And we all feed ourselves. We all want to eat better. We all want to be better. We all have this in common. We want to feed our children well. And can't we just talk about that for a little while? And then we can go back to all those other things. Maybe once we've made a connection, human to human, person to person. And I know it's all kumbaya, but I feel pretty strongly about it.
It's okay. I think there's always room for more kumbaya. I think kumbaya is underrated. And part of the book mentions the importance of being nice, which is also underrated. Easy to say, harder to do. I'm just going to read, you know, we've been talking about killing animals. And I, as an economist, I couldn't resist enjoying this passage. You said, keeping humans fed is an animal killing enterprise. Although vegetarianism keeps the evidence off the dinner table, the animals we don't see, killed by machinery, chemicals, and habitat destruction, are just as dead. I can't find reliable data on how many rats get poisoned each year to keep them out of the grain stores, but spare a thought for them when you reach for a dinner roll. Eating small pieces of large, carefully chosen animals might be a more humane choice than eating only plants. We'd need the rat numbers to figure it out. For me, the question isn't whether we should kill animals or not kill animals. It's how to minimize suffering. I opt out of most conventionally raised meat because I don't like how the animals in our system are treated. My priority is to try to make sure the animals I eat have a decent life and a humane death. The decency of a wild animal's life is probably debatable, and some are undoubtedly better than others, but at least it's not a cage. As their death options go, a clean shot by a hunter is probably one of the better options. That's very powerful. I assume, you have some friends who don't like any kind of hunting and don't find that passage interesting at all.
Yeah, I think that there are people who don't find this compelling. But on the other hand, I've met a lot of people who are vegetarians or vegans who have respect for this kind of take on killing animals. So much of vegetarianism and veganism is driven by, I would say, revulsion at how animals are treated in our conventional meat-producing systems. And most of the time, when I talk to vegetarians and vegans, I don't get hostility. And I've even had people who are vegan come to my house and make an exception for the eggs from our chickens, the venison from the deer that we have shot, because of their provenance. And, you know, if shooting an animal face to face is something that you just object to under any circumstances, I understand that. And I respect that, but I have a slightly different take. But I think it's a take that is not anathema to a lot of people who opt out of meat.
I'm the president of what's sometimes called a liberal arts college here in Jerusalem, and we're supposed to probably think well of Henry David Thoreau, but I did want to get in your cheap shot against him. And I recommend Catherine Schultz's essay, which we'll post to on Walden and Thoreau's personal habits. But you say, I am on record as believing that Henry David Thoreau was a self-important gas bag and Walden is unreadable. But he did say, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. I have to say that, you know, as a long ago one-time fly fisherman and having many other hobbies that require new clothes, for many people, that's a feature, not a bug. But say something about Walden or Thoreau in that quote.
You know, I talk about shtick. He did it just for the sole purpose of fame and fortune. And look, I'm not going to belittle that because, okay, there was an element of that in what I did too. But if you try and have you read Walden, Russ?
Long time ago. And I've caught a trout from Walden Pond when I was about 14 years old on first day of the season when I was living in Lexington, Massachusetts. And I've seen his hut there, I think, you know.
So it is beyond me how this book entered the canon, because all he does is just assert how superior he is to all of his neighbors. And it's unreadable. I do not understand why people are preoccupied with Walden. And but the thing about beware of enterprises that require new clothes, that I have to confess to liking. And again, you know, one of the great things about doing all this stuff is that with the exception of fishing, you don't need a lot. You don't need to gear up. You don't need new clothes. You can just roll up your sleeves and get started. But boats and trucks are the exception.
Yeah. Of course, that's for an ocean goer. It's generally, the surf casting, you can pull in a few fish.
No, you totally can. And that's actually a really good point, because if you're fishing from shore, fishing can indeed pay for itself. And my husband and I live on a lake that's stocked with trout, and we can literally catch them out the back door. And if we limited our fishing to that, it would pay for itself. But nothing pays for a boat.
Yeah, yeah. But except for the pleasure you get from it and the fun of smacking the waves.
Right.
And yeah. Before I forget, I just briefly mention that you can grow mushrooms. I didn't know about this, that you could take logs and soak them in water or let them get rained on. This is a crazy thing. And then shiitakes, right, which are delicious.
Uh-huh.
How do you do it?
This was one of my favorite projects that we did. And so you can grow mushrooms. Well, if you go out in the world, you can see mushrooms grow out of trees because the mycelium, the part of the mushroom that you don't see, colonizes a tree, usually a diseased or a dead tree. And it thrives, it eats the decaying wood. And you can make that process happen. So you buy these little dowels that are impregnated with shiitake spore, and you take an oak log and you drill little holes in it, and you put one of the dowels in each of the holes, and then you stand it up and you wait 6 months, a year, and then it starts to sprout shiitake mushrooms. It's positively magic. It was we were like, shiitake mushrooms. And then what happens is you can make a flush come, because I'm not explaining this very well. You can make the shiitake log flush by soaking it in water. And so since we live on a lake, we put it in the lake for a day and then we take it out. And 2 days later, we have this huge, I have pictures of these logs that are just covered with shiitakes. And it is one of the most satisfying things. And those logs will keep going for several years. So, yeah, you have one afternoon of pretty arduous labor getting all the little dowels and the little holes. But then you're done. And you get mushrooms for years. It was one of the best projects we did. And it is one of the projects that pays for itself.
My dad, and I'll let you react to this, because I didn't sense any of this in your book, but my dad was a very avid gardener. His father was a tomato grower. His dad was an urbanite from Philadelphia, grew up in Philadelphia on the streets. And when he moved to Memphis, Tennessee, he became a tomato grower and cucumbers and other things. And as a boy, I remember having a good time in his garden. And my dad became an avid gardener. But I never became a gardener. My brother is. I don't think my sister is. But for my brother, I think most of the thrill of gardening for him is thinking of our dad and being part of that chain of you call it self-reliance. It's a beautiful, it's not about self-sufficiency. It's about self-reliance, learning to acquire the skills we talked about earlier and making something come out of the ground from a seed. It's like you said, it's a miracle. It's magical.
It is.
And my dad, so I never became a gardener. So it's not a way I connect to my dad, but my dad took me fishing all the time. And I have many, many memories of him sitting in our driveway after a fishing trip to Marblehead, where we would row like a 12-foot boat out into the real ocean. I was always a little worried we wouldn't come back, but we'd catch a lot of flounder and sometimes some other surprises with our friend Lenny. And we'd come back, and my dad would sit in the driveway, and he'd clean the flounder. He, by the way, never filleted them. He's not a fillet guy. He would just take off the heads of the fish we would eat, the freshwater fish especially, and he'd take out the guts. But not a fillet guy. Never passed that skill on to his son. But he did teach me to love fishing. And like you, I can't fish for fun anymore. I can only fish for food. I will fish if I eat the fish I catch. And when I do, I think of my dad. And part of the, I think the what was moving for me about your book isn't just thinking about my dad. It was, this is part of the human experience, how we pull food out of the ground, out of the water, out of the woods, is part of what we've been doing for a very long time as human beings. Regardless of technology, we still have to eat food in some fashion. Maybe we'll get some test tube stuff coming sooner than later that we'll actually be interested in eating, often at a reasonable price. But most of the eating we do of food is primal. It goes back to our most earliest origins. And for me, some of the thrill of my little experience of firsthand food is connecting with my dad, say. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear any of that. Do you have any of that in your life? Was that part of this experience for you at all, or was it just part of this larger idea of the human experience?
I didn't come from a food procuring family. And in fact, I opened the book with the memories of the little vegetable garden we had on the side of the house, which I barely remember except for the mint, which was awesome because I was like, hey, look, you don't have to do anything. It just comes up every year. That was my idea of gardening. But the connection to humans, I think, is very powerful. And I've actually looked to see if anyone has ever studied this, because whenever I meet somebody who gets any kind of food firsthand, whether it's a fisherman or a gardener or a forager, I always say, does that food seem different to you? And every single person says yes. Because I think this taps into this primordial human need to feed ourselves. And so it's an accomplishment of a different order. To me, it's not like, you know, acing a test or getting a promotion or selling a book. It's this other, you know, reptilian thing that itches, and you scratch it by doing this. And, you know, so there's this connection to everything that humans have done in the past that most of us no longer do, but there's a consequence for not doing it anymore. And we have become increasingly removed from the sources of our food. And in some ways, that's very good. Modernity has freed people up to be, you know, doctors and lawyers and engineers and writers, because we don't have to procure our own food. I am not anti-modern. But I think there's a downside when we lose connection with the actual plants and the actual animals that are the foods that humans thrive on. First, we don't get this sense of satisfaction. We miss out on that. But also, we get disconnected from what a decent, healthy diet is. And, you know, I think as a population, our very sense of what food is has gravitated away from the plants and the animals and toward the boxes and bags. And one of the reasons I find firsthand food so compelling is that it can help shift the pendulum back. The things in the grocery store with, you know, the colorful packages and the exciting punctuation don't even seem like food to me anymore. And you still can't leave me alone with a bag of Doritos. They still appeal to, you know, all the things they're engineered to appeal to. But that food is in a different category from the food I put on my table, the food that I feed my family, the food that is the bulk of my sustenance. And I think we could all use a little more of that. And so many people are trying to eat better. And this is one joyful and constructive way to try and do that.
We talked a little bit about self-sufficiency and self-reliance, acquiring a set of skills that allows you to procure your own food, grow your own food, hunt your own food, whatever. But there's another theme in the book, which is about the cooperation between you and your neighbors and the people around you. So when some of my listeners may know, I wrote a poem called It's a Wonderful Loaf, and it's about how bread, the millions of people who work to forget the store-bought bread, if you make your own bread, millions of people helped you get to that point. And when I eat bread and I say a blessing in Hebrew in gratitude for that, I try to stop and smell it and savor the fact that it is the product of not just my effort that brought it to my table, but so many people, not just in the production of it, but the knowledge that is embodied in that bread is also an enormous human set of human connections. And you're not, in this book, mainly taking advantage of that network that's called a market that coordinates the knowledge and efforts of different people. But it's much more tangible because you've swapped things with people because you had too many tomatoes. But more importantly, I think you've leveraged the knowledge of people who've shared it with you. So talk about how that adds to your enjoyment or experience of the food.
It adds enormously because, you know, we talked earlier about how I'm not interested in self-sufficiency. And one of the great things about this is that it's the opposite of self-sufficiency. It connects you to your community. We've learned more from other people who are better gardeners, better hunters, better fishermen than we are. And in turn, we try and pass our knowledge on to other people. And we've met people we would not have met otherwise, but not just meeting them, connecting with them. It's this whole idea of common ground, and we all eat, and this is something we all care about. And yeah, there's anybody who lives in a community like this where a lot of people garden, hunt, fish, forage, taps into the sort of underground economy of the barter system, because mm-hmm. that's one of the things you do when you have much too much. We have friends, they're in the book, our friends Al and Crystal, who have this epic asparagus patch. And, you know, in the spring, we'll trade eggs or clams or oysters for asparagus all day long. And it's one of the joys of doing this. And yeah, we get asparagus, but we also get to have Al and Crystal in our lives. And the most satisfying thing to me is to have people come to our house and we feed them this food that we're invested in, that we care about, to people we love. And, you know, some of them are people who we've met through this enterprise, but then we introduce them to our other friends. And, you know, the people who have taught us to fish and to hunt are there even when they're not, because their expertise is manifest in the pizza with the venison sausage on it. And it's sort of this antidote to bowling alone, and this idea that we've become, you know, ensiled in our own little, in our communities, or sometimes we just spend too much damn time in front of the phone. And this is a way to recapture some of what modernity, I think, has robbed us.
We talked earlier about how this it's not an experiment, but this lifestyle change you tried to adopt into your life as much as possible of firsthand food is something of a luxury. And one of the senses in which it's a luxury is that you live on 2 acres of wooded land on a pond in Cape Cod, which almost by definition, 335 million people can't do.
Right.
Most of us have chosen to live in urban areas mm-hmm. where you could grab a pigeon or a rat, but generally hunting's out, fishing is pretty far away, gardening is limited to your rooftop maybe mm-hmm. or a co-op nearby. And I wonder, you know, I don't think we should romanticize agriculture. You know, life in 1900 yeah. when 40% of Americans were in farming, it's a very hard life. It's at least 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. It's a hard life. It's a dangerous life physically. You know, there's hard parts to it. It's not that fun. We romanticize it when it's a little bit of your life. When it's all of your life, it can be a brutal, very tough life. Weather can take a terrible toll, pests, et cetera. And, you know, we've moved away from most of that. And most of that moving away, I would say, has been good in many dimensions of the human experience. We live longer. We have a higher standard of living. We have 3% of Americans or less now, about 2-something on the farm in agriculture. And that's a tribute to human creativity, technology, and mm-hmm. so on. But we've also lost something. And, given that it's unrealistic for most people to live on 2 acres, what are your thoughts on both the rural-urban issue that this is part of in some way, and also how a person who does live in a city can tap into some of the things you're talking about?
Yeah, so first, living in a city, which I did until the last 12 years, and when it was actually when we lived in New York that the light sort of went on about this, because we did put a garden on our rooftop. We had whiskey barrels and we grew tomatoes, and the building had skylights with these grates over it. So we used them as cucumber trellises and we grew some food there. But obviously, if you live in a city, you're very limited to what you can do either indoors, community gardens, balconies, rooftops, or getting out of the city. And of course, in New York, there's fishing right outside, you know, your door. We lived on the Upper West Side and there were piers where there were fishermen there all the time. And so obviously your options are going to be limited by where you live, but also what kind of financial resources you have, what kind of time you have, what your geography and your climate are going to give you. And I guess one of the important things about this is that it isn't about the bulk of calories that you get, whether you get 10% or 30% or 50%, you can get, you know, 0.003%, but, you know, that basil can really speak to you. And so it's not about quantity. It's the nature of the experience. A thing about modernity, because I've said it before, and I will say it again and again and again, I do not want to turn the clock back on modern agriculture. I mean, Kevin and I have had an oyster farm for 10 years, and I know what it's like to grow food for money. I know about the risk. I know about the loss. I know about the back-breaking labor, because I've done all of that. And I don't wish that on anyone who doesn't choose to do it. And we did choose to do it. But again, that's a first world choice. And so what I think I'd like to leave people with is the idea that, yeah, modern agriculture has been great as far as freeing up the rest of us to do things that we want to do. It has made food affordable. It has made variety accessible. But it's also had a downside in terms of what our diets have become. And firsthand food is about reintroducing some aspects of that connection that people had to food up until, you know, the last 100 years, without giving up on, you know, modern agriculture that feeds us. So I guess I do want us to have the best of both worlds.
My guest today has been Tamar Haspel. Her book is To Boldly Grow. Tamar, thanks for being part of EconTalk.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
This is EconTalk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more EconTalk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for EconTalk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.